Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, cultural enrichment, and all-inclusive fares. Discover more at Viking.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
New York plans to impose the nation's highest rate of income tax as President Biden takes executive action on guns. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We're joined by my colleagues, WSJ columnists Kim Strassel and Bill McGurn. Thousands of people have been working from home amid the COVID pandemic. And there was a journal story last year that said only 10% of Manhattan's office employees were actually at the office in person. And yet the political powers in Albany do not seem too worried about getting back the other 90%. Governor Andrew Cuomo this week struck a budget deal with the legislature that includes some huge tax increases. Bill, what do you think they're thinking up in Albany?
Well, I think one thing that they're thinking of, Governor Cuomo, is he's in a real pickle with the charges of sexual harassment and the charges about how he managed the nursing homes during COVID. So the classic Andrew Cuomo answer to this is to, you know, get allies by paying them off in the budget. And it seems that's what he's doing now. And just it distracts a lot of people. You know, whenever you spend a lot of money, you get a lot of attention. Doesn't necessarily mean that money was spent wisely.
Just to give a sense of the size of the tax increases, a couple of them, one of them is the business franchise tax, which currently is at 6.5%, is going to be going up to 7.25%. And then the personal income tax is one that a lot of people are talking about right now. The top rate is 8.82%, and that's going to be going up to 10.9%. On people making millions of dollars a year. But it's worth noting, Kim, that would be when you add in the New York City local tax rate, that's about 3.9%. You get a total that is the highest in the nation and higher than California.
Yeah, as we wrote in our editorial, take a knee, California, and recognize America's new tax king, because California's top marginal rate is 13.3%. And, you know, you also have to add into this, this is just simply state marginal tax rates. Of course, the people who this is going to hit are also going to be paying federal marginal tax rates, as well as the usual Social Security and Medicare charges, probably that Medicare surcharge as well. You are looking at, you know, close to, if not getting these people to paying more than half of their income in taxation. And this all comes even as we know that there are people, wealthier Americans, who are migrating out of high tax places like Connecticut, like New York, like California, and relocating to places like Florida, which has an income tax of zero. And, you know, that kind of brings up the fact that maybe that explains that provision in the recent COVID relief bill that says that states who receive any of that bailout money can't use it to lower taxes, because this is all a progressive ploy to make sure that not only do they get to raise taxes in blue states, but make it harder for red states to attract new folks to their borders.
But it's always been true that people are mobile and capital is mobile. And yet it is still hard for me to imagine, I mean, almost a worse time for New York to do this than during the middle of this year-long experiment with people working from home. There's a journal news story, I think today, that talks about some of the companies that have moved to Florida or opened new headquarters in Florida during the past year. They include Elliott Management Corp, Icon Enterprises, Blackstone Group. Apparently, Goldman Sachs Asset Management is looking at opening a new Florida office. JetBlue Airways says it might move to Florida when its lease expires in 2023. There's some quotes from the letter from JP Morgan Chase CEO, who says that, you know, in this new reality, we may only need 60 seats in an office for every 100 employees that we have. And there's also some interesting Census Bureau data cited. More than 300,000 New York City households in higher income neighborhoods filed change of address forms with the U.S. Postal Service from March to October last year. So, Bill, I mean, it seems like the message that New York is sending a lot of those people who have spent the last year not in New York is that they might want to think about staying wherever they are.
Yeah, exactly. I think that, you know, the incentives have just changed so dramatically and so fast, and people have discovered that they're more flexible about where they can work than they might have thought before. So we're obviously going to have sort of a hangover from that of people that move somewhere else, and then they say, you know, I could live in this somewhere else very easily and still do my job. So I think the blue states are particularly like New York are just they're playing with fire because they seem to be under the old arrangement that they can do whatever they want in terms of rates. And people are just hostage. Businesses and employers are just hostage because there's no other place where they could do it. And we're learning that that's not true. And it's going to have all sorts of ramifications for taxes, you know, whether they can collect taxes and where people want to live. I think the bottom line of this is more people are going to live where they would like to live and not where they have to live because of their jobs.
Right. And that's a point that I think was made very well in a letter by like 250, more than 250 CEOs, business leaders that signed a letter in March on some of these proposed tax increases. And some of the proposals were a little bit higher than what made it into the actual budget deal. But this is one of the things they say. They say that our, you know, our workforces are more mobile than we ever imagined that they could be. And I'll read a couple lines. The letter says, these new taxes may trigger a major loss of economic activity and revenues as companies are pressured to relocate operations to where the talent wants to live and work. This is what happened in New York during the 1970s when we lost half our Fortune 500 companies, and it took 30 years to recover. And so, I mean, Kim, do you think that the politicians in Albany, including Governor Cuomo, I mean, do they not see that argument, or do they just think that New York is such a luxury good that people will be willing to pay whatever for it?
They do. And that's long been the philosophy. I think the problem was laid out in that CEO letter is that increasingly it's impossible for younger families to live decently in high tax and high cost cities like New York, as much as they might want to go to Broadway and as much as they might want all the fabulous gourmet shopping stores. It's simply hard. That's why you see a lot of them, you know, outside of New York City, in the suburbs, etc. But overall, what we've seen is, you know, these high growth other areas in the country, whether it's, you know, down in the Atlanta area or other kind of middle sized or lower high tier cities where you can simply buy, you know, a 3-bedroom house and it's affordable and you can drive around and it's easy to get places. I think that's one problem. The other problem with that mentality is that New York has substantially changed over the past year. And people saw the problems of excessive lockdowns, and a lot of businesses closed their stores never to reopen. The kind of arts and culture scene there is been devastated. So what are you sticking around for? And then I would add into that, if you're a business, you know, it's one thing for the governor to say, hey, we're bleeding, hemorrhaging here, and this is the really important reason we need to raise your business franchise tax. But the reality is that state revenues, even before this big amount of money that everyone is getting from the federal government as part of the bailout, were running 0.1% what they were last fiscal year. And most of this money is going to boondoggles, like tons of new dollars for schools, even on top of the federal school bailout as well, too.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. Kim brings up an important point, which is all of the federal money that New York and other states are getting as part of the COVID spending relief plans. By some measures, New York is getting $50 billion, some of that for schools, some of that for general budget aid. And so, I mean, Bill, the argument is that there is not really a big hole in the budget that needed to be filled here. It's just that the state legislature, I guess, wanted to expand programs and spend a little bit more money.
Yeah. Well, the way New York's work is that basically the legislatures don't have much to do with it. It's the governor, the Speaker of the House, and the Senate leader. And they go in a room and they hash out their deals. And the governor has a lot of powers here. And that's what he uses to reward friends. Again, this doesn't make any sense in the basis of, you know, what they're spending on. It does make sense if you think that Andrew Cuomo is in a lot of trouble, may be impeached, may be forced out. This is one way to keep him in. And he's a fighter. He'll go all the way to the end. And again, it used to be a different dynamic when there was a Republican Senate. It was kind of a check in New York. And since that's gone, it's not a coincidence Andrew Cuomo's moved more in a progressive direction.
Yeah. And just to underline that a little bit, I'll read a couple quotes from him. In 2019, Cuomo said this. He said, "Tax the rich, tax the rich, tax the rich. We did that. God forbid the rich leave." In his State of the State speech in 2020, he bragged that New York's corporate tax rate was lower than it had been, the lowest it had been since 1968. And it does seem, Kim, I agree with Bill, it does seem like there's a palpable shift in Cuomo's direction here.
Yes, we are all progressives now. and you have to ask what it is driving that. Is part of it an attempt to curry favor with progressive groups that have kind of gone after him on some of these failings that Bill mentioned at the beginning, in particular, and these questions of sexual inappropriateness as well? Is it him simply moving to the left the way so much of the Democratic Party has moved to the left? Does he believe that helps position himself in politics in a better place going forward? It isn't really clear, but we have seen this migration from Cuomo slowly but steadily. And it seems to be getting more radical now. And it's actually a real pity because, you know, all parties do better when there are a range of philosophies across the board. And Cuomo, for a while, was certainly acting as one of the guys that was, you know, preaching some temperance in the party, common sense approaches to things, still to me far to the left of where, you know, my free market views are. But and slowly we're just seeing the evaporation of all of those people.
But that raises an interesting question because, I mean, the next New York gubernatorial election is about a year and a half away, November 2022. And Bill, I mean, maybe you're right that Cuomo is working to shore up his left flank here, but it does seem like he is raising a real question for any voters to the right of him. People who may have supported him as a check on the legislature may be asking themselves now, you know, what they're supposed to do, what those voters are, what's in it for them to vote for Cuomo?
Well, there's no place for them to go, those kind of voters in the Democratic Party, I think. And that's the problem. They're kind of bereft, left without a leadership. Cuomo, for all this, I'm not a big fan of his, but Andrew Cuomo did a reasonable job of, you know, for a Democrat, of keeping spending down. Like, basically, I shouldn't say keeping it down, but keeping it from exploding and getting out of hand. But I think that's all going to go now. I think he needs the support from his party. A lot of them don't trust him. And I think that means more spending.
Finally, on Thursday, President Biden unveiled some executive actions on guns. Kim, can you give us an overview of what he announced that he was going to do and what you make of it?
So I think the ones that are getting the most attention is he's issued orders to have proposals drawn up to crack down on or get rid of ghost guns, which, by the way, I do think, and I'm a proud firearms owner, I do think is something that does require some more study and thought in the policy sphere. Ghost guns are essentially this sort of growing phenomenon you see out there, although it has happened for quite a while, but it's gained in speed where people can go online and buy different parts to firearms and kind of create their own. And officials don't like this because there are no serial numbers. They're not registered. We don't register guns mostly, but you don't have to go through a background check to order these pieces online and create these sort of things. The other side of it is there's a lot of people who do this as a kind of hobby, like law-abiding Americans who, you know, just it's a pastime for them and they are intrigued by it. But, you know, you can certainly also see the side of the fact that you are making firearms that essentially anyone can do it and you don't go through the normal checks. So there's something on that. And then also this question of arm braces, which are basically these attachments to some firearms, make them a little bit more steady when you hold them. I put this in the classification of when Donald Trump did something about bump stocks, which are a little device you can get that allows potentially for more rapid firing of a firearm. You know, they might do something around the edges, but we're not dealing with the real issue about firearms and shootings, which is crime in the streets, people who got their guns illegally, and also mental health issues. And, you know, everything we've ever looked at, every person that's ever engaged in one of these mass shootings, there's clearly mental problems there. And it was really striking to me that once again, Democrats are going at this from how can we restrict firearms and firearm use rather than how do we deal with people who really shouldn't have guns and who really need help.
Yeah, I mean, I guess one of the things that strikes me, though, from these executive actions is just the narrowness of them. I mean, there's a lot of appetite in the Democratic Party for gun control measures. And this is what the Biden administration has come up with, what they can do on their own, doing some rulemaking on these pistol arm braces, which, as Kim points out, it doesn't really address the deep problems here. And it just shows, I think, Bill, the difficulty of trying to do this. This is power over gun control is something that is really in Congress's court. And there's not a whole lot that the president can do on his own.
That's true. And it's also a constitutional right, which the Democrats like to ignore. I mean, every year there's some new kind of hope for, you know, whether it's bump stocks or something, it's some new hope. And of course, it never materializes to be what they say. And I think basically gun control is how the liberals respond to crime. They don't have a good answer for crime, so they talk about gun control. And it, in their group, it probably polls pretty well. But I think that they're playing with fire on this because gun control is also one of those issues that crosses over party lines. You know, you'd be surprised at, you know, who's really pro-gun and so forth. And I think that they have a potential with this very narrow majority in the House and in the Senate for alienating these people if they make this a real cultural battle on guns. I'm not sure that's what I would do if I had the slight majority that they have.
But is one takeaway from these executive actions, Kim, sort of an acknowledgement from the Biden administration of the real limits of executive authority here?
I would hope so. And I have to say that, you know, as much as I think these particular orders aren't going to do much, I was surprised that there wasn't more because this has been an administration that has been a bit excessive in its executive rulemaking and executive orders so far. And a Democratic Party that doesn't seem to want to be or believe it should be bound by some of the normal rules of the game. I think that it was very smart because to have gone any farther than this, you know, for instance, to have meddled in the current background check system would have immediately invited lawsuits. And those provisions probably would have been immediately put on hold. given some of the very clear rulings we've had out of the Supreme Court establishing an individual right. Now, one problem here, and I would just point this out, I keep going back to the court. You know, it did issue its incredibly important ruling in District of Columbia versus Heller, finding that individuals have a right to keep and bear arms. And yet, it didn't get into specifics, and cases that have come along since then, it has ducked, and it is not further explained what the contours of this are, because John Roberts seems to not want to involve his court as much as he can in anything controversial. And so, you know, it's allowed this debate to just continue and to fester, and for the fights to continue going on in the legislative branch.
But it is interesting here. I mean, in the absence of real executive authority, I mean, one of these executive actions is for the Justice Department to come up with and publish some model legislation for a red flag law. And the idea there is that someone who is deemed by, through whatever process, to be a potential threat could have firearms removed from them. And Bill, I mean, I suppose that the Justice Department is free to offer those suggestions, but it's hard for me to imagine a lot of states, particularly any red states, taking those recommendations on board.
Yeah, it does seem as though they're going through the motions, right? Because they've got all these practical limits on them. So they announce something with great fanfare, you know, some big new development, but it doesn't really materialize. And I think that's the dilemma they have now. I don't think there's actually much they can do, you know, in the radical direction that they'd like to go. I just don't think they have the power. So they're pretending it's a lot of noise and fury and hoping people don't look, you know, past the curtain and see the great Oz is really some pathetic middle-aged man from Kansas.
But in the realm of personnel being policy, another piece of news this week is Biden's choice to lead the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. And Kim, what do you make of his selection?
I find this an over-the-top nomination. You know, I generally think that presidents are entitled to have their people around them. But what we saw when Neera Tanden, who had been offered up for the Office of Management and Budget, was pulled, is that there's also a fine balance between, you know, having people around you and then having people that aren't going to absolutely send the other side in Congress, you know, over the bend because they are so partisan. And this guy, you know, he's a kind of anti-gun fanatic. A lot of people on the left are pointing out that he spent a couple of decades of his career working as a special agent at ATF and suggesting that this is what makes him qualified. But I think what's more important is his more recent career. For a while, he was involved with Mike Bloomberg's Mayors Against Illegal Guns campaign, which is a very, very anti-gun organization. More recently, he's been a policy advisor for another extremely gun restrictionist group called Giffords, which is associated with former Congresswoman Gabby Giffords, who was unfortunately shot. But it's one of the problems is that not only is this guy, I mean, this is the equivalent of a Republican appointing the head of the NRA to run the ATF, but the guy just, he has really bad ideas. It doesn't seem to even understand the law. You know, he's been out there. There was a good column by David Harsanyi at National Review talking about how he gave a testimony before the House Judiciary Committee in 2019 and explained that assault weapons were, quote, virtually identical to those used by the military, end quote. That's just simply not true. If he doesn't know the difference between a semi-automatic firearm and an automatic firearm, he has no business being at the head of the ATF. So I predict that this is going to be a very tough nomination, and that would be in keeping. We've had a lot of acting directors of ATF. It's been a hard position to fill in past.
Yeah, it definitely could make for some interesting Senate hearings, and particularly so because guns is one of those issues that doesn't split neatly on partisan lines, and it has a lot to do with whether you're in a rural state or not. And that's why Bill, of course, as people remember, Bernie Sanders was long a pretty staunch Second Amendment defender. And so it could be interesting to watch this nominee go through the Senate.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting. I was very disappointed in this because, you know, there's always liberal nominees or progressive nominees to get through that I would not, you know, I would on the other otherwise oppose. But to put someone who is really an activist at the head of a law enforcement agency, I think that's a new line that's being crossed. I mean, so many of our federal law enforcement agencies are suffering from such a lack of credibility already. I don't think this is a good sign. I think people want to feel that the laws are being enforced fairly and honestly. And I'm not sure picking someone like this with his background, that that contributes to that perception.
Thank you, Kim and Bill. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back next week with another edition of Potomac Watch.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.